Good. So everybody, wonderful. Welcome, London, San Francisco, Dublin, Amsterdam, Buenos Aires, and Norway today. Welcome to the Digital Freedom Fund talk series. Today we have learning from the landmark Microsoft and Google shopping cases. What do they mean for big tech today? And we will have Thomas Vigneault with us in a second. But before we start, especially for those of you who haven't been able to do the whole series, let me be polite and briefly present myself. I am AC Coppens of The Catalyst, a boutique agency based in Berlin, and we work on how science, innovation, and new technologies shape creative work and society. And that's why the Digital Freedom Fund has invited us to moderate these wonderful series, these new series, and we're exploring how we can make better use of the competition law framework to protect digital rights. The speaker series approached so far different issues like how to raise public interest concerns and make complaints count, how do tech giants typically justify their conduct, what is the recent German ruling on Facebook, what has it meant, or what is it still meaning because it's not ready to go, as we were seeing last week. The discussion within the EU on the topic was also approached, what can we learn from previous cases, and much more that all relates to curtailing platform power. And we try to make this know-how accessible beyond the expert spheres. As you know, I am not a lawyer. That's why I'm allowed to ask questions, even questions which are a little bit exotic sometimes. But remember for later on in the chat, I know a lot of you are lawyers, but anyone can ask questions. There are no stupid questions here in this room. You can learn a little bit more about the series in the chat. Melissa, who is here and assisting me on this project by moderating, will push some nice sources. Check them out in the chat. And don't forget at the end of the discussion to save the chat, possibly in case you want to re-click the links which have been pushed there. Now, maybe a couple of housekeeping rules for everybody. Make sure that you are muted and that your camera is off for now. But of course, if you have a question, we might ask you, in case you like to, talk direct with Thomas. You can also, of course, unmute yourself, but then also go on camera. Gladly use the reaction buttons. When you love something, there is the little button with reaction with a little plus. You can click on it and applause, say you like it or dislike. Sometimes I ask a question also on top and we check what you think. So let us see if we will make use of this today. If you have a question, please write it in the chat immediately when you think of it, when it's happening and et cetera. We will come back after the discussion to all the questions. We don't want to interrupt the discussion we have, but I will come back to the discussion, to the questions later on with you. The questions will be nicely filtered also by the Digital Freedom Fund so that I really pick the real great ones. But you know, it's a unique chance that you have in this series to have true experts on specific cases. So make the most of it. Ask questions, take your chance to do that. Good. So I was telling you today we have Thomas Vigneault with us and a lawyer in private practice, partner at Clifford Chance and co-chair of its global antitrust group. And he has an impressive and expressive track record on working on cases at the intersection of competition and intellectual property law. He has advised corporation antitrust law, and he is a non-governmental advisor to the European Commission on certain areas of competition policy. And he also finds time to lecture at the University of Amsterdam, of Zurich, and he is on the board of editors for a couple of journals that look at the intersection between law and technology. And it is particularly exciting to have Thomas with us today because he has worked on nearly every major competition law case that concerns digital platform, especially in big tech. He represented an industry coalition in a complaint before the European Commission alleging anti-competitive behavior by Google in relation to its Android mobile device operating system, the Google Android case. He represented the same coalition as an interested third party in the European Commission investigation into Google for abuse of its dominant position in search, the Google search and AdSense case. He represented a third-party intervener, found them in Google appeals to the European General Court over the European Commission's finding in relation to Google's abuse of dominance in comparison shopping, the Google shopping case. I'm nearly done, but hold on, you have to listen to the end. He also represented the European Committee for Interoperable Systems, in the case against Microsoft over the bundling of Microsoft Windows and Internet Explorer, the Microsoft Internet Explorer case. And he was also involved in the over decade old landmark case against Microsoft for abuse of dominance in relation to their tying of Windows Media Player to the Microsoft Windows operating system. This is the Windows Media Player case. So you see, wow, I could go on. There is more than that, but I was saying really like major cases. And this was a major case for the European bodies tasked with enforcing competition law as it concerned the application of existing conceptions of an abuse of a dominance to an information technology market. So thanks to find the time to be with us, Thomas, today. And I think you are in Norway today, right?
Indeed, I am. I am in my cabin in the mountains of Norway.
This is a wonderful place. So we have a little delay. So I will wait a couple of seconds before you can answer my questions. So we will be patient. We are all ears, of course. And before we go into the heart of the matter, Thomas, I would love to know maybe a more personal way. How did you get involved in taking cases that are at the intersection of competition law, competition policy, and IT systems? What is this law and tech interest of yours?
Well, AC, I would like to say that it was very carefully thought out, but I'm afraid it was an accident. I can tell you a bit how I came to become what I have become.
Sure.
I'm a Norwegian-American, born in Seattle, educated mainly in the United States, but I've spent time in Norway studying, helping build log cabins, driving bread trucks along the fjords, teaching elementary school. And then I studied law at Columbia University and became a lawyer, worked a few places around the world, but eventually began my career at a law firm in San Francisco. And I was given the choice between joining a team representing newspapers and broadcasters in defamation cases, so First Amendment work, freedom of the press work. Mm-hmm. And the alternative was to work on the big dispute between Fujitsu and IBM, where IBM accused Fujitsu essentially of stealing its software. And I thought that going to Japan a lot sounded exciting, so I chose that up. And that, I'm afraid, I knew nothing about information technology or intellectual property, frankly, hardly any lawyers at the time did. So the first day I showed up at work in San Francisco, I was handed a book. And it was a university college textbook called Davis on Operating Systems. And the partner handed it to me and he said, read this book. So I read it. And then I spent the next years traveling back and forth to Japan, working with Fujitsu engineers, ended up responsible for the interoperability aspects of that dispute between Fujitsu and IBM. And then along came another accident. The arbitrators in that case decided, I think, to perpetuate their careers as arbitrators. They decided that they would decide on an annual basis how much Fujitsu had to pay IBM for access to the interoperability information that Fujitsu needed to interoperate with IBM's mainframe systems. And they were going to decide that on the basis of the, quote, then applicable global software protection law. Mm-hmm. And so right about that same time, the European Commission launched its proposal for a European software copyright directive. And we realized that was going to be a big part of the then applicable law and would have a huge influence on how much Fujitsu had to pay IBM for access to this interoperability information. So then we decided somebody had to go to Brussels to interact with the EU institutions about that. And I was the strange Norwegian, German-speaking bird who had spent many hours in windowless rooms with software engineers. So I got sent to Brussels. That was the summer of 1989. I was supposed to remain 1 year, but I was reasonably successful in steering the software copyright directive towards an interoperability-friendly solution. And then I was asked by my San Francisco firm to open an office in Brussels, and the rest is history. So the 90s, I spent working on a number of other legislative projects with the European Commission, the database directive and other copyright directive and the like that had to do with tech and interoperability in particular. I worked on the remedies phase of the IBM case. And sort of gradually being in Brussels, I moved from being an intellectual property lawyer to becoming an antitrust lawyer. And then because of the intellectual property aspects of the Microsoft case, I was asked to become involved in that case. And then the next 10 years I spending a lot of time on the Microsoft case. So long-winded story. And then the other cases you mentioned just sort of naturally followed from that.
Naturally, from the accident, so to speak, and because you read that book, this is how it's incredible how life is made sometimes. But I think it's a great accident. I mean, for those you are actually defending and protecting, I think it was a very nice opportunity. So let's go back maybe to this Microsoft thing. I mean, last week we had Facebook. 2 weeks before, we said a lot about Google. So now we're going to take Microsoft for a change. And can you give us an idea maybe on how this all came about? How did it come to be brought? Who was involved? So I understand now how you did get involved yourself. Tell me maybe something like once upon a time, etc. What happened with the Microsoft thing?
Okay, so one sees these phases, of course, in the IT industry. IBM dominated it, benefited from huge network effects for many years. Then there was a period of quite some years, around about 20 years, when it was the epoch of Microsoft. And Microsoft had a number of monopolies, including its desktop operating system monopoly, and really sort of ruled the world of IT. And in those sorts of, in that respect, the IT industry, in light of its the network effects and just simply the nature of how the markets work, it tends to generate these big antitrust cases. And so Microsoft, I think, couldn't resist, frankly, the temptations of throwing around its monopoly power. And it's not been alone in that regard. It's a very natural temptation. So we ended up seeing three cases. The interoperability case, the media player tying case, which were combined into one big case, and then finally, the Internet Explorer case in Europe. The interoperability case came about in a nutshell in the early 90s, around about. Novell and some other companies came up with innovative solutions to server operating systems. They basically invented workgroup server operating systems. Mm-hmm. AC, you probably do not remember the days. Maybe there's nobody on the call who remembers the days when if one wanted to share one's work with a colleague, one had to put it on a floppy disk and walk down the hall and hand it to them. I do remember those days.
Okay.
And so when Novell invented workgroup server operating systems, that enabled PCs to be connected. And it was a revolution. And it was to Microsoft's great benefit at the time, because PCs became much more valuable when they could be connected. And Microsoft sold the operating systems for those PCs, so it was great. But eventually Microsoft decided to enter that market itself, the market for the server operating systems, the ones that connected the PCs together. And it changed the interfaces between the monopoly PC Windows operating system and the server operating system, and cut off that information to its competitors. So Sun Microsystems, IBM, Novell, and others were denied that interoperability information. And that caused their market shares to drop rather precipitously, and Microsoft essentially took over the workgroup server operating system market. So that is what led Sun Microsystems to make a complaint to the commission, and the commission pursued that case very vigorously. Very briefly, the tying case, the media player tying case was similar to the Internet Explorer case when the tying had actually occurred earlier, but Windows was provided together with Windows desktop operating system was provided together with the Windows media player. So if you bought a PC, you received both the operating system, but also along with it, the media player. And both the commission and the court found that that gave a very considerable advantage to Microsoft and caused, again, the exclusion of competition from competing media players, in particular, Real Networks filed a complaint. And that's what yielded that case. Those were, in at a very, very high general level, the cases. I could say a few words more about the last case, because that case came after the general court, the European court, confirmed the commission's decision. And then a small Norwegian software company, Opera, asked whether I would file a case against Microsoft based upon the precedent established in the Windows Media Player case against Microsoft's tying of Internet Explorer with the Windows desktop operating system. And that case led to an agreement by Microsoft to provide a choice screen, which enabled users when they first acquired a PC to make a choice among browsers. So at a very high level, again, those are the Microsoft cases. I could go on at much too great length, and I'm happy to answer questions.
I am sure you can, but can we just a little question about, like, what were the core elements of law which have been taken there? Was it competition law? What was the argumentation to untie these knots, so to speak?
Yeah, well, on the interoperability case, the key issues were, first of all, were the specifications, the rules basically for interoperation between the server operating systems and the desktop operating systems, were those specifications, those rules, protected by any intellectual property right? We argued that they were not, that they were neither protected by patent nor by copyright. And the reason that was important is because the legal test is stricter when it comes to refusals to license intellectual property than when one refuses, for example, to supply a physical good. There's sort of a privilege given to intellectual property. And so we had big debates over whether there was really any intellectual property protection. And then, assuming that intellectual property protection did exist in those specifications, then there's a big battle over whether the test for finding an abusive refusal to license was met. And there one basically has to show, and the court, when it confirmed the commission's decision in the interoperability case, it really established the law that exists today on refusal to license intellectual property. And the most important element of that case, that principle, was that it found that inhibiting technological development was one of the key factors that the commission had to show in order to find Microsoft's refusal to provide those interface specifications to find that to be abusive. The commission also had to show that The specifications were essential, indispensable to be able to compete. The court found that it was enough if it was necessary to have that information in order to compete viably. So finally, the court decided that it was not going to decide. This was a little unusual, but they decided they were not going to decide whether the specifications were actually protected by intellectual property. They were just going to assume that they were. And then they went on to define the requirements for an abusive refusal to license and found that Microsoft had abusively refused to license those interface specifications.
Okay.
Then there's the mediator tying case. And the tying case, there are a few elements to it. I don't think I need to go through all of them, but one is, are users coerced? Are they forced to accept both when they purchase a monopoly product, which in this case was the Windows desktop operating system, are they coerced? Are they forced also to take another product? In this case, Windows Media Player. That was fairly easy to show, although there were issues that I could discuss, but in the end, both the commission and the court accepted it. And then there has to be a showing of an effect on competition, an elimination of competition. And there, the competitors, Real Networks in particular, were pushed largely out of the market. And so those were the core issues. Again, I'd be happy to answer further detailed questions about it, but perhaps that's enough.
I mean, that's wonderful to get a very good overview on what were the key issues, and that's what we want to get to. Otherwise, I mean, I have to ask the Digital Freedom Fund team, can we add another couple of hours to this call and then we can go on? You know, I mean, it's wonderful. It makes me think like we should put a series with episodes. You know, it's like it's a wonderful, like a novel, you know, now, like a criminal legal novel, what happened back then. So, now, when we look back at this case and the different elements and key questions and arguments which have been used to prove who was actually abusing or not abusing, what was the impact of the case back then? And what did it bring for us today? What stayed? What has been taken over as a natural thing now?
Yeah. Well, first, as I've already indicated, the Microsoft case had a very significant impact on the law, on the formulation of the law, in particular, what constitutes an abusive refusal to supply or to license, what mm-hmm. constitutes unlawful tying. So for lawyers in the tech sphere, it's a sort of a bedrock precedent. But the case had, I think, a much broader significance. And in that respect, one thing I think is important is the Microsoft case, in a sense, made the European Commission. It turned the European Commission into the leading antitrust authority on the face of the earth. The US, of course, has a much longer history and a very sophisticated antitrust enforcement edifice. But the United States kind of got out of the antitrust business, at least in the tech sphere. They didn't pursue any cases. And so the European Commission, by successfully prosecuting the Microsoft case, and it was a big bet because the commission could have lost before the court, mm-hmm. But the commission, it really turned itself into the leader in the world. And it also, and maybe this is the most important legacy of the Microsoft case, is the not only the reputation, but the competence that it yielded. Because the commission, after pursuing that case for so many years, ended up with a group of people in DG Competition who are very, very highly knowledgeable about technology. And if you have an antitrust authority and you're going to take on somebody like Microsoft or Google or Facebook, you'd better be able to understand the technology. Now, those companies and smaller companies too will also always be able to, they'll always have an advantage. They will always know their business and their technology better. But the European Commission has a group of people, many of whom are in key positions today, actually cut their teeth. They began as baby officials, you might say, working on the Microsoft.
Cool, super nice.
And so the people working on the case were quite exceptional people, and that legacy remains.
Super nice. So now, if we go a little bit further, and if we have a look, like, because of your perspective and experience, you can look back and tell us maybe how has competition law and policy evolved since the case concerning Windows Media Player? Maybe you want to draw on your experiences of more recent cases, like the Google Shopping case. Maybe you want to give us some parallels and differences, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the cases, the Google cases, again, they demonstrate the commission's formidable competence. They're beautiful pieces of decision-making. And something that began in the Microsoft case, that the Microsoft case laid the basis for and has continued, is a much more sophisticated economic approach to these cases. What really are the economic issues involved? What are the economic consequences? So there's a far more sophisticated economic analysis than there used to be. When the Microsoft case began, there was no chief economist team in DG Competition. Now you have a group of extremely sophisticated economists. But I could say some other things about how the cases have developed. And frankly, I have been rather disappointed. As you noted, I was rather deeply involved in the Google Shopping case. I filed the Google Android case. And although the decisions, competition law showed itself to be substantively very adaptable and was quite capable substantively addressing those cases, the results were not very satisfactory in the sense that the cases took so long. And as you know very well, these markets move very quickly and they're heavily subject to, in particular, network effects. So if a company sets out to engage in conduct to leverage a dominant position in one market into an adjacent market, those markets can tip rather rapidly. So if Google sets out, as the commission found it to do, to entrench Google search as the search engine in the mobile sphere, and it engages in conduct with respect to its contracts with OEMs, Android OEMs, to achieve that result, it can be achieved relatively rapidly. So if you have a case that takes 5 years to decide, by the time the case is decided, the cake is baked. And it's very difficult to unbake it. And that's where I have to express a bit of disappointment in the commission, because the remedies in these cases are absolutely fundamental. And basically what the commission required in the Google cases was for Google to stop doing what it had been doing that was illegal. But once the conduct has achieved its goal and the positions are entrenched, just making them stop doing it doesn't work. So that comes back to the Microsoft Internet Explorer case. And a little story there, it was actually the chief technology officer for Opera, Håkon Wium-Lie, who's Norwegian and is one of the fathers of the World Wide Web. He was with Tim Berners-Lee at CERN when the web was invented. And he came up with he personally, not a lawyer, a scientist, came up with the idea of a choice screen. But he called it, being a good Norwegian Democrat, he called it a Democrat with a small D, he called it a ballot screen. People are going to vote for their browser. And that remedy and the interoperability remedy in the Microsoft case, they both ended up being relatively successful. And not that they really fixed everything, but the choice screen was intended as a restorative remedy. In other words, the idea was to try to restore competition to what it would have been had the illegal anti-competitive conduct not been undertaken. And that's what the commission has not, in recent times, in particular in the Google cases, has not done enough of. And so you have a combination of much too long to decide a case, the conduct has serious anti-competitive effects, the remedies are not sufficiently robust and aggressive, and finally, the commission in the Google cases, unlike the Microsoft interoperability case, has not pursued Google for non-compliance. I believe at least Google has not actually complied with the decisions. I mean, the remedies were not sufficiently robustly formulated, but even so, Google has not complied. In Microsoft, Neelie Kroes, who was then the commissioner, pursued very aggressive non-compliance proceedings against Microsoft, which were successful. The commission hasn't done that. But the commission realizes, and Commissioner Vestager speaks these days and says, yes, we should have more restorative remedies. Mm-hmm. We should move faster. And that's why now the commission is going to be launching this proposal next week for the Digital Markets Act. Long-winded answer to your question. Sorry,
that's great, fantastic. So do you personally think that the current regulatory instruments for taking on big tech are maybe not enough? I mean, maybe we have competition law, we have intellectual property law, we have data protection law. What do we need more to attack specifically problems of digital tech?
Well, competition law, as I said before, has shown itself to be very adaptable, very flexible. So I think substantively the law works. To repeat myself a bit, the problem is that the cases take very long because they're complex technologically and economically. Fancy lawyers are very good at coming up with delay strategies by using their due process rights. And so I think there is a serious difficulty with using pure competition law. One thing that the European Commission has started doing more of is using interim measures cases. So that's a mechanism whereby the Commission can, in certain circumstances, but very limited circumstances, require the company to make changes to its conduct very early in the case. And then the incentives reverse. And the Commission's Broadcom case demonstrates this, because the Commission required Broadcom to change some of its contracts. It imposed an interim measures order on it. Mm-hmm. And then the incentives are reversed, because instead of having an incentive to drag things out as long as one can, then the company has an incentive to resolve it as fast as it can, because it's the one who's, you know, suffering in a sense. Not really suffering, but you know what I mean.
Yes, yes.
And so then that case, within a year after the imposition of the interim measures, the case was resolved. But the problem with that is the standard imposed by the European Court on the European Commission for imposing interim measures is a very strict one. So I do not see that as a panacea. So that leads to the question of whether something like the Digital Markets Act that is going to be proposed next week will fill that gap. Will it enable things to be done quicker? I mean, that proposal will establish rules on so-called digital gatekeepers. Mm-hmm. And once digital gatekeepers are decided who they are, they will be subject to some so-called ex ante rules on apparently some forms of self-preferencing. I don't especially like the term self-preferencing. It's far too vague. I think every Article 102 case could somehow be deemed a self-preferencing case, but there will be some so-called ex ante rules on self-preferencing, interoperability, something on data. And so the idea is those will be self-executing, and whoever is deemed to be the gatekeepers will understand what they have to do and they'll just do it. We shall see whether this works.
I should have been interviewing you next week, actually, or we have to do another session to ask you, like, now, how do you find these digital market ads, right? Especially, are you hopeful, or are you expecting really new stuff in regard to emergent new technologies? I'm thinking of specific things like AI, data cases, blockchain, quantum technology. I mean, can the law keep up to the pace of technology, or is it also so slow to be able to give rules, right?
Well, again, I think the substantive law has over decades shown itself to be sufficiently flexible, adaptable. The challenges are more, so I don't think it's really a problem with the substantive law. I think there are big challenges because some of those things you mentioned will require learning a lot of new stuff. I mean, quantum, I frankly don't understand quantum myself. I read newspaper articles, but I don't deal with engineers on that. So that's going to be a big challenge.
Yes.
And again, you're going to have the same problems of things, the cases go very slowly. But data is something is going to be clearly very central. It's already been a big part of the Google cases. And the commission has been investigating Google and Facebook and appears to be intending to launch new cases squarely focused on Google's and Facebook's gathering and combination of data and use of data, in particular in the online advertising sphere. So data is going to be very, very central. But there is, again, the big question, will the commission be able to act rapidly enough? Will this new legislation help address that? And maybe I could say one other thing, which is something that you asked what more might be needed. Some would suggest, and I'm not sure I'd take a personal position on this, but some would suggest that in some cases, the answer is to break the companies up. And we've all seen that just yesterday, the Federal Trade Commission and 46 American states have filed a lawsuit, and at least one of the remedies they've sought is to undo the acquisitions, the Instagram and WhatsApp acquisitions. Now, that could be argued as the most effective remedy and the way to restore competition, turn the clock back. Facebook will always argue, it doesn't work and it's unfair and all that sort of stuff. But the European Commission, even though technically speaking, it does have that tool. I mean, in the law, the Commission has the power to break companies up, but it's never going to break up an American icon as a political matter. We all know that's not going to happen. So I think maybe the Commission officials are looking across the pond with a bit of envy these days. Now the Americans are finally really doing something, and they have this tool that, technically we have, but we really can't use.
Gosh, and then what happens? I really I want to know, what's going to come now, coming up next to all these new technologies, and see if law can actually have enough of rules or need more to come up. Are you yourself, you've been bringing some pioneer work back then with the Microsoft case and et cetera. Are you excited to be part also of further pioneering measures, maybe? Would it be rewarding to you, and to bring it back to a personal question at the end? Yes?
If I'm lucky enough to be asked to be involved, then of course it will be fantastic. Especially since these things, I decided to become a lawyer when I was 16 because I was going to save the world. I was very interested in civil rights, environment. I have not saved the world. I have certainly not saved the world, but I do think that these things, the digital antitrust cases, I think they become much more important because these issues are not just economic issues, they're social, political issues that go right to the heart of democracy. So I think the interface, you used to have the antitrust IP interface. Now you might say you have the antitrust democracy interface. So if I'm asked to be involved, I will find it a great, great privilege. Yes.
Thomas, you are saving the world indeed, because as we know here by the Digital Freedom Fund, we say that digital rights are human rights, right? So this is great. I think we have a couple of questions. We have a bunch of questions, actually. So much that I have to read on every possible channel I have here. So we have a more technical question because of your double expertise. So it is in view of the importance the issue of interoperability has these days, primarily in terms of interoperability in social networks, do you think the enthusiasm and the optimism associated with the mandatory interoperability introduced in the NCT is founded? We see a divide here between those saying that it is a workable measure and those saying that big tech know 1001 behavioral means to circumvent the requirement, making it nothing but another instance of consent fatigue. What is your stand on this?
Well, it's a very, very good question based on reality. Mm-hmm. I think there underlying that question is clearly a dose of pessimism. And I think it's appropriate to have a dose of pessimism, skepticism. But at the same time, I think the Microsoft case is really rather relevant there. I mean, in that case, Microsoft was required to provide the interface information necessary to achieve interoperability between the desktop and server operating systems. Microsoft played games with it. So the one underlying premise of that question is that those who hold the information, those who hold the cards to interoperability, have all manner of games they can play. And that's absolutely true. And Microsoft basically played two of them. One, they provided a pile of spaghetti, which was basically undoable and unusable. And secondly, they imposed charges, fees for access to the interoperability information that was unreasonable. But in that case, the commission, and this is Cecilia Madero, who was the head of unit at the time, and this is one example of how individuals make a difference in history. He made the Microsoft case, and he was very, very bullish, and he just didn't let Microsoft get away with it. And Nelly Cruz, the commissioner at the time, believed in that, and the commission went after that very, very doggedly on both those issues, took one of them, the fees case, up to the court, and that worked. I mean, there is actual interoperability between those operating systems, so it actually worked. Now, one could be a little pessimistic insofar as those were complex systems, but interoperability in what we have today, in some respects, is perhaps more complex, more difficult to force. So that's a rather long answer, I guess, where I think there's room for both optimism and pessimism. And one thing is that if enforcers are going to address it, they're going to have guts. They're going to have to really confront those who inevitably are going to play games.
Sounds very exciting. I have another question here. FTC and SAS lawsuits against Facebook yesterday. What does your crystal ball tell you, particularly in light of the composition of the USSC?
Whoever asked that question has put their finger on what I think is the key issue. And that is, and this is where the US antitrust authorities and the states, you know, they face a big challenge. They face a federal court system that is that consists of a lot of judges appointed by Republican presidents who tend to be Chicago school type thinkers and typically rather business friendly and not very friendly towards restrictions on business. And so not only at the Supreme Court level, but at the district court and at the appeals court levels, you have a lot of judges who have an innate skepticism of these sorts of cases generally, and probably also towards the ultimate remedy, the breakup remedy. I don't think any of us quite know how this new Supreme Court, it really is a pretty new Supreme Court, is going to work out. I mean, there's certainly some indications that they might be skeptical, quite skeptical of robust antitrust cases, but I don't feel competent to make any prediction in that regard. But it certainly is the big question related to that case. How are they going to do in the courts? How are the judges going to react to it?
Okay. Do we have more questions from the chat? I mean, come on, this is unique. I mean, it's such a nice conversation. So feel free, please, to ask in the chat. Otherwise, I had prepared a couple of more questions. Hold on. Oh, yeah, of course. I am an Apple user. So, of course, I'm going to ask you, what is the impact of the Microsoft case on concern around Apple's iOS dominance? For example, Spotify complaint against Apple. What would be your take on that one?
Well, I have to disclose, I filed the complaint, Spotify's complaint against Apple. So I have a self-interest in that case. There's certain things that I can disclose and cannot disclose. But precisely, what was your question? And I will try to answer it. Maybe you could repeat it. I'm not sure.
Yes, of course. I was asking you, hold on, I was noting it here. Where is it? Yes, I wanted to see basically me being an Apple iOS user, so to speak. I wanted to see if there were parallels or lesson learned from what was the impact of the Microsoft decision on today. So what the impact of the Microsoft case would be on these other types of operating systems like Apple, so to speak.
Right, okay, well,
to make it more general.
I mean, there is certainly some relevance. Let me just basically say, and this is in part Microsoft related and in part not. The theory of that case is that Apple has a dominant position with its App Store, that it controls the access that developers have to consumers via the App Store, and that it really is a monopoly insofar as there are no competing App Stores. Google has a Play Store and Apple has its App Store, and they do not constrain each other in any meaningful way. And then the theory of the case beyond that is that that Apple engages in two types of conduct that we regard to be unlawful. One is it requires music streaming competitors, and it's very important that Apple is a competitor. Apple provides its own music streaming service. So it's a direct competitor. It disadvantages its competitors in music streaming by requiring them to use its payment mechanism with a 30% fee. Whereas if they were to open it up to competition, it would be rather easy to get a 2 or a 3 or a 4% fee. And that then puts the competitors at a very, very substantial disadvantage, which is extremely significant given the margins of those businesses and the very, very intense costs related to acquiring the music rights. And the second piece of conduct is that Apple denies the ability of those competitors to make their users aware of the opportunities to acquire the service, for example, on a website. And so they prevent Spotify, for example, from communicating with their own their own customers. So that's what's at issue, and so
that's
Apple is very much in the
yes. Okay,
I've seen a few other interesting questions in the chat. We have time.
Yes, exactly. We have this question, why did the commission miss the problems with which the Google double click and Facebook WhatsApp mergers would mean? And as regards the latter, what do you think of the Bundeskartellamt investigation and ensuing litigation?
Okay. Well, I was very deeply involved in the double click, Google double click acquisition. I was representing Yahoo at the time in that matter. And frankly, I think the commission, again, Cecilia Madero, who was then the director responsible for the IT space, he understood it. And some in the commission understood exactly where it would head. We don't have time to discuss where it would head, where it's headed, but it sounds like the questioner understands where things ended up. But it was, there was a bit too much crystal ball gazing at the time. The law requires the commission to have rather concrete bases for making predictions about anti-competitive effects of mergers. Now, I thought then, and I certainly think now, that they had enough. But basically, there were those within the commission who wanted to prohibit it, and others who felt there was just too much vague crystal ball gazing. On WhatsApp, it was basically the same sort of situation. The commission didn't feel it had enough in terms of concrete evidence that Facebook and WhatsApp potentially competed with each other. That I think was a big miss, which now might be undone in the United States. And I think I don't have time to say much more about that, but I would answer the final question. I am a big fan of the German Facebook decision. I think it's one of the most innovative and meaningful cases in the tech sphere of recent years. And we shall see where it actually ends up.
Yes, we will. It's still in progress, as we saw last week with Miriam Bayetzen. So, yes, I have another question here. Competition and IP, democracy. What is your view on another matter, competition and industrial policy? Maybe for the last couple of minutes. Competition and industrial policy. Yes.
Well, that, of course, is a very hot topic in Europe today. You have the German economics minister, I believe that's his title, and Commissioner Vestager being at loggerheads as a result of the Siemens-Alstom merger case, where the commission prohibited it, and the German government, the French government, believed that the European Commission should look further ahead towards competition from Chinese entities, and should take a different approach to market definition and basically implement a kind of an industrial policy, especially in the commission's merger decisions. It's calmed down a little bit, that debate, but we do see things moving in that direction, which some would regard as a protectionist direction and some would regard as something which is really necessary for Europe to protect itself from rapacious advances from, in particular, China. So we're seeing more foreign investment control laws being adopted in member states, and we're seeing action at the European Commission level as well. And I would predict that we will see more industrial policy taken into account in the European Commission's merger control decisions. It's just it probably won't actually be called industrial policy. They won't actually admit what they're doing, but they will take a more expansive view, for example, of market definition, which enables them to include Chinese competitors, whereas they might not have in the past. So my prediction is to prevent potentially much bigger revolutions imposed upon them by the member states, the European Commission will expand things a bit to deal with that political issue. That's a very general answer to the question, I realize, but I see that we're 1 minute from ending here.
Absolutely. Well, you are, I see that you are sensitive with the timing. So am I, as a chief time officer. Unfortunately, we are arrived at the end of this hour, and I must say it is very difficult because it was the last episode of this series, this talk series about competition law, digital rights, and human rights, so to speak. And I think you have been showing wonderfully also the link from very legal, technical questions leading to more democracy. So I think it is wonderful that you are saving the world, Thomas, as you were saying. So this is great to have had you here with us today. Thank you so much to have been my interview partner. I really have, I hope that I will have another opportunity to interview you with the further development of the Digital Markets Act coming up. So now for all of you who haven't been able to attend all the series, I have an announcement to do. First of all, in case you want to have all these great resources that Thomas is suggesting, before you leave the chat, don't forget to save it. There are these three dots after the chat, and you can have all these links there. And then we will also have the opportunity, if you follow the Digital Freedom Fund on Twitter, on LinkedIn, you will have the opportunity to know which link will be publishing all the series sometime soon. So we will have Niamh Dunner with Enforcing Competition Law, How to Raise Public Interest Concerns and Make Complaints Count. We will have Miriam Bayeten. Did Germany really just outlaw Facebook's business model? We heard in every talk that it was a major case. So how to understand the impact of the federal Supreme Court decision will be also published. We will have Konstantinos Tyliano, Reigning in Big Tech, How Competition Law Can Help Protect Digital Rights. And we will have again Thomas Vigneux, learning from the landmark Microsoft, Google Shop and Shopping case. We saw that we went way beyond this and have been even like predicting a couple of things between us. It was really super interesting, super exciting. I really enjoyed the conversation. I enjoyed all the talks. I hope you also did, all of you. And yes, well, it's time to say goodbye, I guess. Enjoy yourselves. Have a wonderful end of the year. And you will maybe see me again in the recording, and I hope to see you again soon for the next series coming up with new episodes. Bye, everyone.